Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe and give us some feedback. Also, the Bald-Faced Truth podcast, it's brought to you by Shoe Mill, my favorite shoe store with locations in Portland and Salem and online at shoemill.com. Shoe Mill, where we put the world at your feet.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to the Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth.
I've been watching this Michael Jordan documentary. I know you have too, The Last Dance. I knew he was fantastic, amazing, greatest player who ever played, in my opinion, but I forgot how good he was. I am really enjoying watching him. Frank Brickowski, former NBA player, shared the hardwood with Michael Jordan and a number of other great players. Brick, are you watching this documentary?
Johnny, I am. I think I'm on episode 6 or 7. I've been kind of watching one every week or so, trying to space it out. Just the opposite of binge watching because I'm enjoying it so much.
There is a Brickowski sighting on the court in episode 8.
Yeah, my phone blew up.
Brick, what do you remember of Jordan and being on the court at the same time as Michael Jordan?
You know, there's so much I remember, and the one thing that allowed me to get to know Michael more than anything was he always had an affinity for the working class players, which I considered myself. He didn't like superstars, the stars, because he wanted to kill them, but he had a certain amount of respect for the working class guys, so he was always really good with me, and I was in Milwaukee for 4 years, so we played him 6 times a year. But I remember one sequence, and I've talked about this a couple times since the episode 8, because I've gotten some attention here over this and done some different interviews, but we were jumping after the same ball, and he jumped and I jumped, and obviously I'm a flat-footed white guy compared to him, but we both went up, we both had a chance for the ball. He chose to come down real quick and go back up and get it, and then it got bobbled loose again, and I remember thinking, as I'm trying to get this ball, how come he gets to choose to go up and come down real fast and go back up again? And then on the second jump, he chose to stay up there a little bit. And I'm like, I remember walking over the bench in a timeout thinking, it's just not fair. It's just like, that's not okay. You know what I mean? It's like, who chooses to go up real quick and come down real quick or go up and hang for a second to give yourself – so anyway, that another time – I got a good run at him, a couple of steps, and he was coming, and I was coming, and I was one of the stronger guys in the league, and didn't bounce off many people, but I met him in the air, and I had a full steam, and I gave him everything I had, and I bounced off him, and I was like, I outweigh this guy by 50 pounds. Why am I bouncing off this guy? But he had strength that you can't account for. He had speed you can't account for. He had lateral speed. He had end line to end line. He had the whole package. That's what made him so vicious and so deadly.
I look at sort of your career timeline, and it really does span. It almost coincides with him. You know, you're with the Sonics in 84, and, you know, he comes into the league a couple years after that. And then, you know, you were there all the way through, like, you know, the late 90s. So you got to see him. What was he like as a young player to play against versus maybe when he got a little bit of seasoning?
The talent was always there. I remember one time in Seattle in 84, he was a rookie. He got the ball, and I was out in front of him. He was going down court, and I took off running as fast as I could. And I turned, and I saw him over my left shoulder, and I ran as fast as I could, and I kind of glimpsed over my right shoulder, didn't see him. I glimpsed over my left shoulder, didn't see him. I turned around at the foul line of the other end, and I turned around, and he wasn't on the floor. He was in the air, and he dunked on me. And I'm like, that's never happened before on the basketball court, I don't think, because as I was turning to look, he was going the other way. As I was turning to look, he was reading me. And then I turned around, and it was too late. So then you saw him mature as a player, right, starting to trust, like you see in the documentary, and Phil Jackson, and starting to trust his teammates and bringing them around, and that's when he became successful. And he didn't win nothing until Scottie got there. So Scotty was a big part of those championships.
Frank Brickowski with us, longtime NBA player. Brick, if he never gets Phil Jackson, is he still Michael Jordan, or is there a different narrative?
That's a big question, and I haven't been asked that. I text Phil. Phil, I'm in Montana. Phil's on the lake here. He has a home on the lake right near me. And I text him right when it started coming out. I said, what do you think? And his quote was, it's Michael's version. People involved are wondering, ... But good show. So it is Michael's version. And I think Michael, to his credit, has been real vulnerable in his struggles and been real vulnerable. It maybe put him in a bad light to some extent, which lets me trust the version of this show. So kudos to Michael for it.
There is the perception that the players of that era and your era, that there was a little less camaraderie, and you wanted to beat each other in a way that maybe guys today, I don't know if the money did that or if, you know, there's more a camaraderie with players, or players are moving around more, so there's less sort of that team hatred. What do you think happened from the basketball of the 80s and the 90s to today's game?
Yeah, and there's so many facets to that question. We could spend a couple hours talking about this, but one of the biggest things I saw, and I think I've talked about this on your show before, one of the problems I have with today's game compared to when I played, or compared to a playground in New York that I grew up on, where you had to come with it. If you went to the hole, you better go to the hole strong, or you end up on your back. And that was just honest basketball. And a furtherance of that is when I played, the superstars were the ones who won championships. Michael, Larry, Mike, Magic. And you earned your superstardom by winning championships. And then David Stern came along with his brilliant and his genius marketing. And he said, well, if we can get you, if Wall Street likes you and you sell sneakers and product, we'll make you a superstar. And that tainted the game for me, where the Anthony Hardaways and the guys that came in and were superstars, well, you hadn't won a championship. Okay, you're talented and you're a first-round draft pick or a number two draft pick, but you haven't done anything in this league yet to earn that. And that's where I think it went south for me. But in the same breath, I'll say, David Stern made us all a ton of money, and God rest his soul.
Frank Brickowski with us, longtime NBA player. Brick, the narrative, too, is Jordan wasn't nice to his teammates. And in Episode 8, it literally ends, or Episode 7 ends, with him in tears sort of talking about, they said, hey, you're not known as a nice guy. And I think it was surprising to Jordan to hear that, because I think he thought, well, that's just the way I competed. The way he treated teammates, could anybody else have treated teammates like that and got away with it? Or was it sort of accepted that he was doing it? He would never ask a teammate to do anything he wouldn't do himself.
You know, he can do a lot more things than anybody else can. So that, I don't think that's fair, but I think he demanded they compete every night, and that was the separation. Like I'm most proud of me and my career and the way I competed every night. I really didn't have a choice. If you did something to me or scored on me, it was on, not by choice. And I think that's the issue he had with Horace Grant. That's the issue he had with other players that didn't compete every night like he did, weren't as hungry as he was, didn't battle like he battled. And I think that's Michael Jordan. And you know, I think he's matured a lot in this latest marriage and later in life. I think if you look at his acceptance speech at the Hall of Fame, which I was embarrassed by, it was all-consuming, all Michael, rather than you look at his speech at or memorial at Kobe's memorial, a vastly different person and a much more matured person. I think basketball or sport, it consumes you, and you don't have perception of how am I treating these people, how am I treating those players. You know, I have these random memories of getting in fights and regretting those fights and regretting what I did, but you're consumed. You're trying to survive. You're doing whatever you can. And I think that's, at the competitor's heart, I think that's a lot of what you saw in Michael.
I think you hit on something early in this because you talked about how he was good to you. He respected you. And you're a guy that grew up, you were playing on playgrounds and you had to grind and fight and scrap your way. And you had to do that on a daily basis to stay in the league. I think that those same things that fueled Jordan, that's very relatable. I mean, that he was probably more like you in that sense than he was other very gifted star players who could just get along with their natural talents in the league. He probably didn't respect some of those guys because he thought, hey, they could be so much better.
No, I think you're exactly right. It's sort of the thing you see when great players try and coach. They demand what they gave out of their players, and they're just not getting it, so they're not successful coaches. I could see Michael, if he ever tried to coach, not being happy, not being successful, because it's a different mindset. It's a different world. I remember I enjoyed playing against Horace Grant because Michael would give him such a hard time that it would kind of be counterproductive for Horace. And Michael would just say, just compete, just friggin' compete, just compete, just compete. You know, he'd be on Horace, and I'd be laughing about it because Horace would just go into a shell and just be dejected, and I'd be like, so anyway, I enjoyed playing against Michael. I think Michael might have enjoyed playing against me. I don't know. But I remember one time I gave him a shot, and he tried to take my head off on the next play. And I was like, oh, man, I don't want to mess with Michael.
he deals in Episode 8 with sort of the creation of fake enemies. He admits that he made up a story one time about a guy that disrespected him just because he needed to feed off that motivation. We see some of that, don't we? Russell Westbrook does a little bit of that. Damian Lillard does a little bit of that. Is that a common thing you see in sports and in basketball where guys will look for a reason to give me some extra?
I don't think it's I'm sure we do it intermittently, right? Like I said, I didn't have a choice. I didn't have to manufacture stuff. I remember going to arenas and just thinking, how am I going to play? It's February 20th, and I don't even know what city I'm in. I don't know who we're playing, but I'm not going to be able to play tonight. I knew I wasn't going to be able to play, but then someone hits me or we get it on. And I think that's what Michael and the guys you mentioned, Damian and Russell, they have a chip on their shoulder. Like somebody did something to them. I laugh about these scenarios Michael paints and how people buy into him. Look, he's going to whoop your ass regardless of what he makes up in his head. He's going to assassinate you regardless of whether you've done something or not. So I just chuckle at it because, come up with whatever you want. He's an assassin. He's going to kill you. He's going to try and kill you.
Is he a guy that would be easy to hang out with now away from basketball? Because I wonder about people who are wired that way. Like, where does he get that today?
You know, I've hung out with him. I go to his birthday party every year because I'm good friends with Larry Miller. Larry Miller allows me. And then Michael, he's just always really kind to me. And I want to ask him, why are you so nice? Why are you so nice to me? You know, I'm like, but we've hung out, we've partied, I played pool with him for I think it was 9 hours in the afternoon in Denver a long time ago. It was T.O. and myself against Charles Oakley and Michael. We all had time to kill. It was a dead day during the All-Star weekend, and we had a ball. He's just a normal guy if he perceives you as inside the circle, right? If you're safe to him, he's just a normal dude. Another time during an All-Star game in L.A., we were in the lobby of the Beverly Wilshire, and it's early morning, and Charles Oakley comes up behind me and grabs me from behind, and we laugh, and he gets a phone call, and he said, talking to Brick. And he goes, okay, and he hung up, and he goes, let's go. So I just follow him out the door. We go to this other tower. We go up, and we go to Michael's suite, and he has a gambling game still going on from the night before. It's 9 o'clock in the morning. And I look around in the room, and all I see is piles of cash. And I'm like, my mind goes to, oh, we'll put sleeping gas underneath the door. I'll get knocked out with everybody else, and we'll split the profit. And I saw Oak the next day or later that night, and I said, Oak, well, how much money was in that room? There was like $1 million in there. And he held up two fingers. There was $2 million cash in that room.
It's amazing.
And I'm one of the few white guys that's allowed in those rooms with Michael and his boys, but Michael had a propensity to gamble. He could afford to gamble. So you can say it's a problem or not or judge him, but I don't judge him. I mean, the guys who made the money and they enjoyed the gambling, it gave them a way to escape from the game and the grind. But to answer your question, Michael's a normal dude if he's in a safe environment, and he creates the safe environments. Like at his birthday parties, there's a roped off area where we can just hang out, and he can relax. He's enjoyable. He's a normal dude. You know what I mean? It's like he's not the superstar when he relaxes. He's just a normal guy.
Frank Brickowski with us, former NBA player. Brick, what's going to happen? Are these guys going to finish the 2019-2020 season? Is it going to get bagged? What's your sense on where this goes?
You know, I have my hopes. I can speak to my hopes that we get this thing back up and going in a safe manner. The reality of it is none of us have answers. You know, the league doesn't have answers. We at the union, we don't have answers. And we're just kind of hoping, right? So, you know, hopefully science leads the way here and we follow the science, but you know, that guy in the White House does what he wants, you know? I'm embarrassed by some of the things that come out of the White House. I would love for everybody to follow the science and be safe. I've lost an aunt, not necessarily to COVID, but to the lack of services provided to my aunt who was struggling in her health and wasn't able to get the services she needed to survive, and we lost her. But, I mean, when the people stop passing, that's when I personally want to move forward. Hopefully the rest of the leagues and everybody do the same. You know, I don't know. It's a tough time for us all.
Yeah, it's strange. We're on new ground, and I think you're right. I think the right answer is I don't know, right? Because we don't know what's going to happen in the coming weeks, coming months. You know, we didn't know when this started, but I'm glad you're safe, and I appreciate you coming on and sharing stories, man. It's always great.
All right, everybody stay safe.
You too, buddy.
Thanks, Johnny.
Frank Brickowski, great stories. Can you imagine walking into that room, Judah Newby? $2 million, you're watching them gamble, you're just standing there, and they've got piles of money. Pretty surreal.
He's like, I'm like the only white guy in there. Not that I'm self-conscious or anything. $2 million, and he just walks in there, and Jordan's just doing it casually. That's amazing.
Alabama Adriana, you walk into a room, and they're gambling, there's $2 million on the table. How wide-eyed are you?
I do that on the daily basis. That's nothing new to me. So
I love it. And look, I love the part, too, where Brick sort of talked about, for people who know Frank Brickowski, you know, he had this reputation of being a very physical bruiser, physical player, New York background, playgrounds in New York. He knew all that stuff. I do think his comment about Michael Jordan sort of respecting the rank and file journeyman player maybe more than some of the star players of the league is rooted in the fact that Jordan was wired more like the journeyman player as a competitor and was fighting every day to be there and probably looked around at some of the other star players who were just gifted athletes, some of which had more athleticism than Michael Jordan, and went, look at these guys. Look at them wasting their talents. And he went after those guys and made meals of those guys.
And Brick mentioned it, but I mean, like his teammate, Scotty Burrell, like some of the anecdotes that Jordan said about Scott Burrell, who was not as talented as Mike, but man, that's your hardworking working class player right there. And MJ maximized Scotty Burrell unlike any other teammate ever could.
He said that in the documentary. He says, I'm trying to raise that guy's level so that when we face fire, he's ready. Mm. Everybody around us has got to be better, but it's got to be incredibly frustrating when you are looking around going, we're not getting it done. We're not getting it done. And you hold yourself to that negative reinforcement, which Jordan did. Focused on the Orlando Magic because they knock him out of the playoffs. Focused on Isaiah and the Pistons because they knock him out of the playoffs. And then it just becomes this maniacal, that is never happening again, drive. Leave it here. You got the BFT. I'm told it's a beautiful day outside. I have not yet been outside. I better get outside. I think it's supposed to rain and be cloudy for about the next 5 or 6 days. Is it still sunny out, Adriana, outside your window?
It's pretty cloudy, but the sun is definitely out.
Man, I need to get outside. There have been a few days where I have not left the house. I don't know how healthy that is. Chris Miller is coming up. former NFL quarterback. He's got a new job. He's going to talk about it. He's been in the XFL recently. I'll ask him about Justin Herbert.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.